You're listening to a podcast from 702.
Ok, thank you so much for staying with us here on the Eusebius McKaiser Show. And of course, this is a broadcast that is focusing in particular on what it is that is happening to us as a country right now and what we each need to do minute by minute to try and make sure that we flatten the curve as we are battling the pandemic of COVID-19. But when we hit the pause button over the measures that are announced that have to be implemented, including the national lockdown starting tomorrow night, there are realities, social realities, that don't go away because of the virus. One of those realities is gender-based violence, violence against children, spousal abuse. For some of us, home is a sanctuary. For some of us, home is a place we want to flee from because we are literally, physically, emotionally, and otherwise unsafe. And during a national lockdown, it would seem as if, given the national conversation in the last 24, 48 hours, there isn't much of a discussion in terms of prioritizing safety that has focused so far as I can see, in the blogosphere, radio, TV, here and there, but not much on what the practical implications of the national lockdown for scores of women and children in particular that may be unsafe during a national lockdown. And someone who wrote a fantastic piece on this and always has devoted an incredible amount of legal skill intersecting with social and political realities on these kinds of themes is Professor Bonita Meyersfeld. Her piece on the Daily Maverick I came across while I was processing this for myself the other night, and I thought I must have her on the show, and coincidentally, she also tweeted a link to it that I've retweeted. Associate Professor of Law at Wits University, and she joins me now as one of two guests. She's also the founder and chair of the Board of Lawyers Against Abuse. Bonita, good morning, and welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks, Eusebius. Good morning to you too.
We're also joined by Dr. Shahida Omar. Shahida is no stranger to the show, in fact, a friend of the show's, and an excellent South African we dearly love, as an executive director of the Teddy Bear Clinic. Dr. Omar, good morning and welcome to this discussion.
Thank you, Eusebius, and of course, thank you to everybody out there.
Bonita, I'm going to start with you. I try and balance criticizing gaps in the planning for the national lockdown with some generosity for a government caught off guard, because that's true the world over. And so the question of what about the safety of many women and children isn't one that has loomed large thus far, and there's a lot of detail that's missing. So one can forgive the gaps, but it is important, given the scourge of violence and the war on the bodies of children and women, that we now center that immediately.
I think, Eusebius, that the gap is as a result of a pre-existing reality of not really taking seriously the seriousness of the problem. It's actually not unusual that in a time of crisis, be it one such as the one we're experiencing, or in a time of conflict or war or some kind of natural disaster, that the first social phenomenon that is forgotten and the last one that is remembered is the fact that there is a low-level but palpable war committed by men against women and children. Very aware of the generalities that I'm using, but they are backed up by the statistics and by the social constructs. And it's a phenomenon that repeats itself. We saw that in Nicaragua after the shocking environmental and conflict that shook that country in the 1970s. We see it in the DRC. We see it in a multiplicity of areas where there are these huge disasters. And the first thing that is forgotten and the last thing that is remembered is actually there's this pre-existing phenomenon that is going to be exacerbated by the crisis, and that is the phenomenon of gender-based violence.
Yeah, I almost feel silly for the way I framed the question, Dr. Omar. Bonita is right, isn't she, that it is unsurprising that our response to crises is gendered
Indeed, and I think if we just look at this, we're all focusing now on the isolation, the social isolation, the external isolation, but there's been a gross oversight in terms of the protection of women and children. And the reality is that this is, as Bonita so beautifully said, it's a pre-existing situation. And you highlighted that home is supposed to be a place of sanctuary, but in actual fact, it's actually a place for many to flee from. It's fear, it's panic, it's a lockdown, locked into further suffering, further trauma. In fact, this isolation is inducing secondary victimization on an already marginalized and vulnerable group. And I think I want to actually shift the focus on the lack of engagement or the level of engagement between government and civil society. Everybody's scrambling at the moment. Confusion seems to be the order of the day. But there's still this lack of engagement, communicating and consulting with people on the ground who are providing specialized services. Mm. In terms of clarity of essential services, nobody actually knows. And child protection organizations have not been factored into this equation. And that is something which is a glaring oversight.
So I just want to get that straight. As we speak, child protection services have not been placed on the list of essential services.
Well, it's not clear. It's definitely the mention was made yesterday of auxiliary social workers. But it's very blur, it's very confusing, and child-designated organizations, child protection organizations, are not actually brought into the picture or even consulted or informed of what their roles and responsibilities will be. As we speak, I received emails from organizations in Pietermaritzburg, the Northern Cape, Eastern Cape. They've had no communication whatsoever. Some of them have made the decision, some children's facilities have made the decision not to send children back home, but which means they need to organize childcare support, they need to organize a lot of the infrastructure to ensure the safety from the COVID-19, and they've had no kind of no financial support, no information. So everything is in a state of disarray and confusion.
That's not good, Bonita, not least because we have only about 30-odd hours or so before the shutdown starts. I want to shift just to women for a moment. We'll come back to the children in a second. You've tried to be proactive and listing practical things that one might do under the circumstances. There's a lot of obvious things we can critique that's missing, and importantly so, like Shahida has just listed, Bonita. But share with the public three things that you thought are feasible that one can do to begin to try and reduce some of the safety concerns that are real concerns for women of our country.
Sure, thanks, Eusebius. And let me preface it by saying they are very light-touch interventions. And we can obviously discuss what I think those proper and effective interventions ought to be from the part of government.
Mm.
What I propose as individuals is the following. The first is to actually phone, to call, and to call a person whom you suspect may be hurt or whom you know is being hurt, and just phone them, and phone them every day.
Mm.
The point of phoning is not to ask them about the violence, and certainly not to tell them what to do about the violence.
Mm.
In fact, it needn't be mentioned at all. The point of phoning is to just intervene in a situation where a woman may be vulnerable, and it has two consequences. The first is that somebody knows that you care.
Mm-hmm.
And after this lockdown, it could mean that she is in a position to actually leave an abusive relationship because there was someone who constantly cared and checked in.
Mm.
The other reason why this is important, and it's a theme that is true to all three of the recommendations I make, is that it shows the abuser that somebody's watching, that there's a presence. There was a fantastic campaign that was done many years ago called Ring the Bell. And the campaign showed, for example, a person sitting in their kitchen drinking some tea, and then the next door neighbor They heard shouting and screaming, which was obviously an abusive relationship going on, a moment of violence. Mm. And it showed the woman getting up from her kitchen, going to the next door, and ringing the doorbell. Mm. And the abuser came to the door, and there was obviously a sense of trauma going on. The abuser comes to the door, and the woman from next door says, "May I borrow some sugar, please?" And he gives her a cup of sugar, and she goes back to her home and puts down the sugar on the table next to a full bowl of sugar that she already had. Mm. In other words, all that was needed was a momentary intervention to remind the abuser that, in fact, there was an outside world.
Yeah.
And it's the same principle with the phone call. Mm. Just phone. And it doesn't matter if the person doesn't answer the phone. Do it every day.
Yeah.
That's number one. Number two is really we've got to start calling the police. There is a strange phenomenon where we fear bringing police into our phones, and we understand the reasons for that. But if we hear something that sounds like violence, don't err on the side of thinking you're wrong. Err on the side of thinking you're right.
Hmm.
Phone the police and let them determine whether the situation is violent or not. Let them be the judges, not you. And don't think, well, somebody else will phone or the victim herself will phone. You phone, because if everybody else thinks, well, somebody else will phone, hmm. nobody will phone,
hmm.
and the police will never come.
Hmm.
And let me be clear, I'm not overstating the role of the police. And that in and of itself is a complicated issue, but it's what we have accessible at the moment. And again, mm. why is that? Because it shows the abuser that somebody's watching
mm.
and that there is some kind of intervention that might happen.
Mm.
And the last is a very human appeal, and that's if you know somebody who's being hurt and if you can, help them find another place to stay.
Mm.
Now, how do you do that? Well, for some people, it means bringing them into your home, particularly a child. If there's a child that you think is being hurt and you can and are able to do it, offer for that child to come to you. If you are not able to do that, help people find shelter. They are closing down the shelters.
Mm-hmm.
The Center for Applied Legal Studies recently had a client who was actually evicted from a shelter. This is just not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to actually be funding those shelters. So take a fewer cans of beans and start putting your money towards a shelter if you can afford it.
Mm.
And if you can't afford it, at least help somebody try and identify where those shelters are.
Absolutely.
And this brings me to the point that I think government should be doing is a very concerted effort in establishing shelters in the same way that they are creating interim housing for people who are homeless.
Mm.
I think that they do need to be taking a similar approach to creating places, safe places, for abused women to access and abused children to access.
You call it fairly a thin base. I think it would make an enormous difference. All three points that you've explained so beautifully, and that's apart from government also listening to the fourth point that you've added. 22 minutes after 10.
Socialdistance.co.za.
The only place to go while at home. Social distancing.
Dr. Omar, children, sadly, are often used as tools in the wars between partners that have breakdowns in their relationship. Can we speak practically, as Benita has done now, about children? I've had a number of my listeners reaching out to me privately about, for example, custody over this time. Let's take a scenario such as a child is supposed to be, in terms of visitation rights, seeing the other half of the blend of the family next week or this weekend, but if I keep the child until midnight tomorrow night, then maybe I can spite Shahida and I can have the child for the next 21 days.
Yes, as you see, yes, I think these things have not been thought through. There's obviously, because of the pandemic outbreak, I don't think any discussions around this has even been brought to the table at this point in time. And that is of grave concern, because who then explains to people in terms of their rights and responsibilities? And of course, there's going to be continued conflict between the two caregivers, caretakers, mm. their legal guardians. So obviously this needs to be addressed. But I think for me, the bigger concern is that children are going to be locked in. And we know already that, you know, in terms of corporal punishment and punitive measures of disciplining children, parents are going to be irritated, annoyed. Mm. And we look at the overcrowded circumstances of the majority of the population. One needs to understand that how are parents going to manage their own emotions, their own unresolved issues, the conflicts? You highlighted the issue of domestic violence, which is very rife as we speak, the gender-based violence challenges. We know that the government has spoken about the command center, but does it have the capacity? How are people actually going to access those resources? Do everybody have access to phones? So in terms of practical responses, I think what Prof. Bonnie spoke about was that as neighbors, as caring people, as community fellow beings, one needs to reach out, make it one's business to look out for children, because in reality, we know that in one room, there's 10 people living and children are going to be confined inside. So what happens to those children inside when there's domestic violence? Children are often used as pawns, where the one tries to get back at the other parent and the child is always caught in the crossfire of that vengeance, anger, etc. So as community, we need to ensure, we need to look out for the well-being of children. But I want to also raise the issue around Bonita's response to contacting the police. So I want to say to you, having already spoken to a few senior ranking police officers, something that they highlighted was that when they are, you know, when patients, I mean, victims of abuse or child abuse come to their attention and they are reported and brought to the station or they go to the homes, they actually don't know how they're going to manage that moving forward. Who are they going to take it to? How are they expected to counsel, contain those children? Are they expected to take them to safe houses? Will safe houses be available? So there seems to be many questions when we speak to emergency services and essential services like SAPS.
That's
so that immediate response is not going to be a favorable response or in the best interests of children.
That's right, yeah. Bonita, I'm going to give you a minute for the final say. I have the same concern as Dr. Omar. Even if magically the police suddenly do understand that they need to take domestic violence seriously and that domestic affairs are affairs that ought to be investigated, if I want to have my rights as a parent enforced during this time, or I don't trust what my partner is doing to my child, etc., I wonder what level of prioritization one would get. And even if I reached out to you as a lawyer, practically how the lockdown will affect your ability to help me as an attorney or as an advocate or as a legal center even. 1 minute.
There's no question that we cannot do what we would ordinarily or optimally do. Our lawyers aren't even able to get into courts with our clients to assist with the court processes because the courts aren't letting in more than a handful of people or the people directly affected by a particular case. There's no question. I think both you and Dr. Omar have made it very clear where the practical limitations lie. The answer is twofold. The one, we really can be quite creative about this, including the creation of hotlines to log those complaints to be dealt with afterwards, if necessary. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, there really is all that's within our control is to remember that it's happening, it's extreme and it's dangerous.
Yeah.
And is actually the minimum that we can do has to be done.
Mm. Absolutely. Check in with your friend regularly. Give a call, even if it goes unanswered. If necessary, do call the police. And if you can provide a place of safety or help seek one for someone who's abused, make sure you do so. Those are minimum things we should be doing during this time. Bonita and Shahida, thank you so much, as always, for your excellence and your generosity in terms of thinking about invisibilized communities that we really should also make sure we never forget about during crises.
Thank you.
Thanks, UCBS.
Live Podcast presents History for the Future. Lessons from a Rivonia trialist. This is Andrew Mlangeni's story.
I'm a back room boy. I operate from behind. But the police did not know much about me. I was a person who did not want to hold leading positions in the organization. I helped those who want to become leaders and make sure that they get elected.
History for the Future. Lessons from a Rivonia trialist is presented by Live Podcasts.